In Mexico City, a worrying trend with the pandemic.
Hours-long lines at oxygen suppliers are now the norm. Thieves have stolen them from delivery trucks and hospitals, and the black market price for tanks is sky high.
Paying through the nose to breathe. Also today, the children of former ISIS fighters are languishing in refugee camps. Their home countries don't want them. Repatriation comes with a political cost.
There's also a political cost to doing nothing. And that political cost is going to be seen when these children are re-radicalized.
I'm Marco Werman, and the Australian Open gets underway. As players in hotel quarantine work on their ground strokes. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to be with you on a Monday. People in Myanmar are pushing back against military rule. A week ago, the generals in Myanmar decided to end the country's brief experiment with democracy for the good of the country, said the military. But in recent days, crowds of protesters have taken to the streets to say otherwise. This is not the first civilian uprising in Myanmar, but as we hear in this report from The World's Patrick Nguyen, this time the protesters have a new weapon, the internet.
The military in Myanmar doesn't want the world to see what's happening inside the country. So they keep shutting off the internet, hoping to sever the country's link to the outside world. But it's not totally successful. People are managing to get videos out, like this one. More than 100,000 people across the country denouncing the coup every day for 3 days running, marching, chanting, singing, reviving this classic Myanmar protest anthem set to the tune of Dust in the Wind by the rock band Kansas. The lyrics are about never forgiving the army for seizing power. Now, I wanted to speak with one of the organizers of these protests, and I wasn't sure I could get through with the internet being sporadically cut off.
Hello. Yes, this is Tetsuwe Nguyen.
But we got lucky. Tetsuwe Nguyen did pick up. And what this activist is doing is risky. The army has a long history of shooting protesters. It happened in 1988 and in 2007. But in 2021, there's a certain X factor. It's the internet.
I couldn't imagine life without internet. How would the revolution look like?
The internet is still an emerging phenomenon in Myanmar. Just go back 10 years and only 1% of the population was online. Even mobile phones were rare. The military made it so that SIM cards cost $1,000. Only the elite could buy them. But in more recent years, the army loosened up, in part to make Western sanctions go away. They did so reluctantly, worrying that people would one day use the internet to resist. And now, they are.
That is the power of online, that we can make the resistance. We have to show them how brave we are.
Tetsuwe Nguyen says social media is now crucial, not just for urging people to join protest, but for things like arranging safe houses for people fleeing police. This is why the military has tried to block Facebook and Twitter.
They are trying to control the information flow.
Is it working? Sort of. The online shutdowns are glitchy, off and on. Plus, activists are quickly adapting, using VPNs, and finding other creative ways to talk to people outside the country. Tetsuwe Nguyen says they've even gotten tips from protesters in Hong Kong and in Thailand.
We are also doing the three-finger salute that they use in Thailand.
The three-finger salute, just holding up three fingers, a symbol of resistance from the dystopian Hunger Games films. Protesters in Thailand do this to signal anger with their military rulers. It is now taking Myanmar by storm, because it's an easy way to denounce the army that doesn't require a big incriminating sign, which could bring extra charges from police. And speaking of police, police firing into the air to scare away protesters. Yesterday in a town called Miawari, in videos somehow posted to social media. But so far, this is the exception. There has not been a sweeping crackdown yet. Riot cops are out, but many protesters are giving them flowers, urging them to join their movement and side with the people. Tetsuwe Nguyen is not complacent, though. He assumes he could go to jail any day now. I asked if he was having second thoughts.
No, we have to do it. No choice. You know, we have to show them that we can't accept it.
Can't accept it. The hardest part, he says, is explaining all this to his 7-year-old daughter and 4-year-old son. Tetsuwe Nguyen is 35. He says the country cannot go back to how it was when he was a kid, to military dictatorship, with dissidents whispering in tea shops, scared to death of getting caught. Still, to his fellow citizens, he says, don't fall into the trap of thinking social media is the main battlefield.
We're going to make the revolution from online. Online is a good starting point.
A starting point to galvanize anger and get people out of the house.
Revolutions are only successful when all the people of the country are on the street.
For now, they are. And the rest of the world will be listening, whether the army likes it or not. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
It's been over 2 months since Ethiopia's government declared victory of the Tigray People's Liberation Front. But in some areas of this part of northern Ethiopia, fighting continues, and aid groups warn of an imminent humanitarian crisis. Hospitals are struggling to offer basic services, and for many in Tigray, lack of electricity, water, and communications remain a problem. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi brings us this update.
The conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region has caused more than 60,000 Ethiopians to flee across the border into neighboring Sudan. But that's a small percentage of the millions who remain inside the region. Atua Baratola is the president of the Ethiopian Red Cross Society. During a recent press conference, he said the situation in Tigray was deteriorating minute by minute.
I think we have to make this clear. There is no area which is not affected by this conflict, including the town of Mekele, the capital city, needs humanitarian support.
Hospitals and medical facilities have been looted, crops destroyed. For months, Ethiopia's government severely restricted the UN and other international agencies from accessing parts of the region. On Saturday, the World Food Program said it struck a deal with the Ethiopian government to expand its humanitarian access. WFP Director David Beasley posted this video on social media from Tigray's capital, Mekele.
We're bringing in about 20,000 metric tons of food that'll support about 1.3 million people and the millions of people in need here in the Tigray region because of the conflict. And people are hungry.
That work will support the Ethiopian government in providing a million people with food. Last week, Ethiopia's Deputy Prime Minister, Demeke Mekonnen, told reporters that humanitarian relief is a priority.
Our government focuses on rehabilitation, reconstruction, and on humanitarian issues, and at the same time, addressing the issues related to refugees.
The refugees in Tigray he's talking about are from neighboring Eritrea. There are more than 90,000 living in refugee camps. Many of them have lived there for years. And they're also getting caught up in this recent conflict. Until recently, Ethiopia's government was preventing the UN Refugee Agency from visiting those camps. But last week, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, was allowed to visit one of them. This is what refugees told him.
They also spoke of infiltration of armed actors in the camps, of killings, abductions, and also some forced return to Eritrea at the hands of Eritrean forces present in the areas.
Ethiopia has been accused of receiving support from Eritrean troops during the conflict in Tigray, although both governments have denied this. The United States and the UN have said there are credible reports that Eritrean troops have committed rape, murder, and other crimes in the region. The U.S. has urged all Eritrean troops to leave. I spoke with one Eritrean refugee living in the Adi Harosh refugee camp in southern Tigray. He asked to remain anonymous, fearing for his safety.
The situation is very bad. There is the pressure. There is the stress, fear. From whom is the force harming us? Who is keeping us?
He says it's not clear who's responsible for the killing of refugees. Adi Harosh camp, where he stays, has been spared the worst of the fighting. But there are reports of two other refugee camps in northern Tigray that have been attacked, aid buildings destroyed. As of today, the UN Refugee Agency has been denied access to those areas. Officials are urging Ethiopia to provide full humanitarian access. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
We want to take a moment to remember one of America's top diplomats. George Shultz died this weekend at the age of 100. He held four different cabinet positions under two presidents, including Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan. But Shultz will perhaps be best remembered for his breakthrough summits with Russian leader Mikhail Gorbachev that ultimately brought an end to the Cold War. For some perspective, let me turn to Madeleine Albright, who also served as Secretary of State under President Bill Clinton, not to mention as Clinton's ambassador to the United Nations. Secretary Albright, thank you for being with us to remember George Shultz today.
It's my honor that you asked me.
So he became Secretary of State in 1982 when U.S.-Soviet relations were perhaps at their lowest point, very tense. There was a lot of suspicion and hostility between the superpowers. What was Secretary Shultz's approach to steering the U.S. through that precarious moment?
Well, he was able to see possibilities for some kind of a way to have a different relationship. It was when there was a new leader, Gorbachev, and he had a foreign minister, Shevardnadze, who were people that were also looking for ways to get out of a very dangerous situation.
So we got to remember this was an era when President Reagan had dubbed the Soviet Union the evil empire. There were anti-Soviet hardliners with a lot of clout in the White House. How did George Shultz buck the prevailing wisdom and win Reagan to his side? Because Shultz was not anti-Soviet per se, was he?
Well, I think he was very much somebody that could solve problems, that had an understanding of where this country could go, what the Soviets had in mind, and of understanding personal relationships. And he also had an awful lot of background in terms of what I call bureaucratic politics, of being able to deal with other parts of the United States government and of putting himself into other people's shoes, whether they were American counterparts or the Soviets. And he was able to deal with Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, and he saw a problem and he wanted to solve it, and he was excellent at that.
Edward Shevardnadze, that was Gorbachev's foreign minister, correct?
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
I mean, some tantalizing stories have come out since the death of Shultz was announced, and one wonders what could have been. At the 1986 summit in Reykjavik that Shultz engineered, Reagan apparently told Gorbachev, "It would be fine with me if we eliminated all nuclear weapons." And Gorbachev replied, "We can do that." That's according to George Shultz. Could Shultz and others have made complete elimination of nuclear weapons a reality in that moment?
That's something that people talked about, but I think with difficulty, even with the great talent that George Shultz had. What is interesting is that Shultz, until recently, has been still talking an awful lot about the elimination of all nuclear weapons. But it's a real what if in terms of what would have happened earlier, and life would have been very different. But it's hard to visualize, frankly, that the situation would have been such to eliminate all of them at that point.
Mm. So now the crisis that the world faces is not the Cold War, but climate change. And interestingly, it was a problem that Shultz recognized, even if not that many people in the mainstream were talking about it. He even drove a Prius and put solar panels on his roof. He said 8 years ago that fellow Republicans who deny climate change would soon be mugged by reality.
It's not a matter of opinion. It's a matter of fact that the globe is warming. I have three and soon to be four great-grandchildren. So I'm thinking, I've got to do what I can to see that they have a decent world. And if we let this go on and on the way it's going right now, they're not going to have one.
Secretary Albright, why do you think George Shultz's brand of pragmatism has fallen out of favor with today's Republican Party?
Because he is somebody that I think was in many ways a philosopher and at the same time a scientist and a dreamer. I mean, just one of the best combinations of characteristics for anybody to have, and it was an honor and a pleasure to know him.
Madeleine Albright served as U.S. Secretary of State under President Bill Clinton. She also served as U.S. Ambassador to the UN. Madam Secretary, thank you very much.
Thank you for asking me.
Just ahead on the show, the value of oxygen in Mexico City. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. When it comes to the pandemic and numbers, Mexico has recorded the third most deaths in the world behind the U.S. and Brazil. Hospitals across Mexico have become so overcrowded, a worrisome trend has emerged. Many people are stockpiling medical oxygen canisters at home. Now there's a shortage.
Por amor a la vida, devuelvan los cilindros.
For the love of life, the man is saying, please give back the oxygen tanks. The words there of Ricardo Sheffield, head of Mexico's Consumer Protection Agency. As we hear from the world's Jorge Valencia in Mexico City, it's an ordeal for people finding oxygen canisters or even just getting refills.
Outside of one oxygen distribution warehouse, on any given time of day, as many as 80 people wear face masks, stand in line against the wall, and wait. Barely anyone speaks. The only sounds are birds chirping in a tree and people dragging oxygen canisters as the line occasionally moves. Daniela Trejo Rodriguez has been here for more than 2 hours. She's made it close to the front.
Ahorita, pues, estaría trabajando. En atención a clientes.
Trejo says on a day like today, she would be at her job in customer service. Instead, she's outside this oxygen supply warehouse near downtown Mexico City to refill two small canisters for her father back at home.
Nos empezamos a asustar cuando bajó a 89.
She says she and her relatives became concerned once her father's blood oxygen level fell below 89%, then below 81, then lower. The recommendation is to seek medical assistance for anything below 90.
Llamamos a la ambulancia y fue cuando nos dijo que...
When Trejo's family called an ambulance, she says, they were told all public hospitals were virtually full. That's when they decided to keep her father at home. He's 60 years old and earns a living taking care of cars on the street for tips. He was fortunate. Trejo says some cousins found two oxygen canisters for the family to borrow and two more to rent.
Pues algunos primos nos ayudaron a comprar algunos. Y nos prestaron unos.
Trejo's family is far from alone. From Mexico to Brazil, medical oxygen canisters are scarce. Here in the Mexico City area, where more than 20 million people live, hours-long lines at oxygen suppliers are now the norm. The city has four government-run sites where people can refill tanks for free, and there are a few dozen private sites. Government officials are begging private citizens to give back tanks they're not using. Thieves have stolen them from delivery trucks and hospitals, and the black market price for tanks is sky high. They're going for $1,000 apiece.
Pues siempre hay gente mala, entonces esa gente le va a ir mal o le va mal.
There's always going to be bad people out there, says Carla Dominguez. She and her husband are outside the warehouse looking for an oxygen tank for a relative.
Lo que uno hace se le regresa.
She says she wishes no ill will for anyone, but the what comes around goes around. Dominguez's family has fanned out across the Mexico City area trying to find a tank, so far without success. Toward the back of the line, Alejandro Amaro is waiting to refill two canisters.
Tengo tres enfermos de COVID, pero ahorita mi mamá es la que está requiriendo el oxígeno.
Amaro says his brother and his father have both tested positive, but it's his mother who needs the oxygen. He says over the previous week, she's needed refills three times a day.
Sí, al final yo vengo ahorita, otros familiares vienen más tarde.
I'm here right now, Amaro says. Other family members will come tonight, and somebody else will come overnight. He guesses he's come here 15 to 20 times for refills. Back at the front of the line, Daniela Trejo Rodriguez says she's come several times too. She says she knows many people aren't wearing face masks and physically distancing, but things can change very quickly.
Ojalá en serio nunca les toque a algún familiar se les enferme. Porque es una situación muy fea.
She says she hopes no one has to experience a relative getting sick. 3 days later, she tells me over the phone that the oxygen was not enough for her father. He had respiratory failure and died. And the line of people waiting for oxygen is still there. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
Syria has been at war for nearly a decade now. One of the great tragedies of the conflict, tens of thousands of children stranded in refugee camps, the sons and daughters of ISIS fighters. Virginia Gamba, the UN Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict, described the situation this way.
These are the children who have been left adrift by conflict, like flotsam in the sea.
Joining me now is Sarah Kayali. She's Syrian and a researcher for Human Rights Watch, where she investigates human rights and violations in Syria. Sarah, there are 27,000 children in one camp alone, the Al-Hol camp. Tell us, first of all, who these children are and how they ended up there.
Many of them are Syrian, some are Iraqis, but then some are also nationals of third countries whose parents had actually either were taken to Syria to join ISIS or who were kidnapped and found in Syria and while their parents were fighting under ISIS. So you have a large number of children who ended up trapped in these camps after ISIS had been territorially defeated and with nowhere to go and no country that's really willing to take them.
I mean, the UN's counterterrorism chief has called the conditions in the camp horrific. Sarah, what are their living conditions like?
There's a lack of sanitary water, lack of sufficient shelter, significant malnutrition, particularly among the children. I mean, I've been to these camps several times, and every time I go, it's overcrowded. The situation is worse than the year before. And what we've seen up until August of last year, where children were dying because of these conditions, because of malnutrition, because of easily preventable diseases.
So there are children from 60 countries in the camps, as I said. They are the responsibility of their member states, not of Syria or the groups that control the camps. So are any nations taking responsibility?
Some countries have repatriated their citizens. Russia and Kazakhstan are two of the major countries that have done this. But we've seen small ad hoc returns by France of some children, the U.S., Germany, and Canada just repatriated one orphan child. This obviously, compared to the numbers that are still trapped in the camps, is nowhere near enough and is not a systematic way to address the problem. Countries have chosen what we call very sympathetic cases to the public to repatriate.
What are you encountering, Sarah, when you urge countries to take their nationals in these camps seriously?
When we speak to policymakers in different countries, really across the globe, we're first met with hesitancy. No one wants to take this on. It's too complex of a policy issue. There's a political cost to it. But from Human Rights Watch's perspective, there's also a political cost to doing nothing. And that political cost is going to be seen when these children and the women are re-radicalized, when they're able to smuggle themselves out. And what we've seen so far from the repatriations that have happened is that the security risks haven't really manifested. Most of these women and most of the children who had been repatriated, they're not in a position to form the security threat that most policymakers are concerned about.
Yeah, and I see only about 1,000 children have been repatriated so far. What do you think these kids need once they are repatriated?
A lot of these children are very, you would imagine, very, very traumatized. Most of what they can remember is about being in a war zone in Syria or trapped in a camp. And so they do need quite a bit of support in terms of psychological assistance. And that's also why it's very important to repatriate them as early as possible, because the longer you wait, the greater the negative impact and the more difficult it is to reintegrate and rehabilitate them.
Sarah Kayali is a Syria researcher for Human Rights Watch. Sarah, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You're with The World. Hi, it's Marco. Here at The World, we ended 2020 strong by raising over $100,000 to support the show and this podcast. Thanks to you and these listeners: Dagmar Dickey, Dr. Farhuad Faraji and Dr. Arnold Chun, Laurie Dickus, Shole Aminat, Susan Murray, Pedro Orthanes, Eduardo Macedo, Tanya Hyatt Evenson, Clover Van Steenberg, Antonio Pisig. Thanks for your support throughout 2020 as we dive headfirst into 2021. Iraq's existential crisis, not ISIS, but rather Iranian-backed militias, unleashing a new wave of violence.
Now they've turned against their own. So they've been killing anyone who criticizes them, who they deem a threat.
Also ahead, Nigerian farmers take on big oil and win.
And it felt like justice after so many years.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A high-stakes game of chicken is playing out between the U.S. and Iran. It's all about reviving the Iran nuclear deal signed in 2015. The Biden administration says the U.S. will not lift economic sanctions on Iran until it complies with its commitments. Iran says ex-President Trump unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018, so it's on the U.S. to lift the sanctions first. Here to discuss all of this is Suzanne Maloney. She's the vice president and director of the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution. Suzanne, how much pressure is there on both sides to come back to the table and rejoin this nuclear agreement right now?
Well, there is a certain degree of urgency for both sides. For Washington, I think there is a desire to demonstrate a return to multilateral diplomacy, to signal to the world that the Trump era of go it alone and maximum pressure on adversaries is over. There's also, of course, real concern about Iran's breakout from its obligations under the nuclear deal and continued progress toward what could be a nuclear weapons capability. From the Iranian side, they have been under very severe sanctions over the course of the past 2.5 years that have significantly degraded their foreign exchange reserves, their ability to repatriate income from any oil sales they are able to conduct, and just generally to manage financial transactions in anything like a normal fashion. And so I think you have a sense of urgency from both sides to get back to the deal. But as you suggested, each side is trying to impress upon the other to move first.
Right. So there's political pressure in Washington, it sounds like you're saying, in lots of places around the world, to now create a tougher deal that would push off by more years any breakout point for Iran's uranium enrichment. I mean, that sounds like it could be pretty difficult to get to.
Absolutely. And I think the original expectations under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the 2015 agreement, were really grounded by a sense of pragmatism about the need to simply ensure that the nuclear program was capped within Iran. So I think the key for the Biden administration is really going to be to take a very broad approach to ensure that there are wide consultations to avoid being rushed back to the deal, as the Iranians might prefer them to do, in order to get the sanctions relief as quickly and cleanly as possible, but also to ensure that there is a process of negotiations, that there is actual diplomacy underway, which has been largely lacking over the course of the past 4 years.
So, Suzanne, what are the factors and pressure that Iran is feeling right now that makes coming back to the table more of an absolute necessity than they might be letting on? Maybe their cards are not as strong as we think they are.
Well, the Iranians have some financial imperative to get back to business as usual. This is, hit the maximum pressure strategy hit the Iranian economy very hard at a time where the system was already struggling to provide sufficient employment and to spread the wealth of what had been an oil boom around the country in a somewhat equitable fashion. So there is a lot of pent up social anxiety in Iran. Fury that has erupted in 2017 and 2019 and 2020 at the government for the failure to ensure real economic growth and the trickle-down benefits of any reopening to the world reaching the population.
There's also news that the UN envoy to Yemen is in Iran. Does this look to you to be a serious effort to get Iran's allies in Yemen to also come to the negotiation table to end the war there? And do you think it could be connected to any hopes that the nuclear deal could get renegotiated?
Well, I think we have to be working on all fronts with respect to Iran. There has to be a concerted effort to try to end the war in Yemen, and that does entail involving the Iranians directly. They are major players in that war, and there can be no serious ceasefire or end to the conflict without the Iranians essentially backing that outcome. But I think what we see with Martin Griffiths' trip to Tehran is just a broader effort on the part of the Iranians to assert themselves as a major player around the region and around the world. It's sent senior officials to Moscow and Delhi in recent weeks. And I think the intent is really to demonstrate that the relationship with the U.S. is situated in a larger context of wide diplomacy for Iran, a certain comfort level that they are no longer isolated as the Trump administration intended to do.
If you had to put a timeline on how quickly the U.S. might rejoin the deal, when do you think we might see this happen?
It's a $50 million question. My expectation is that diplomacy will be underway within the next few months, but quiet diplomacy. I don't think there's going to be an easy process of returning to the original nuclear deal, and certainly not an easy process of negotiating a better agreement. There are Iranian presidential elections that will take place in the middle of this year that will complicate the timeline from their side. And so I think that Secretary Blinken and other senior officials from the Biden administration who predicted that this is going to be a long haul are entirely correct.
Suzanne Maloney, the vice president and director of the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution. Good to have your thoughts on this today, Suzanne. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now to Iraq, where street protests have been growing over dire conditions there. For the next few minutes, we're going to speak with a filmmaker who's been looking at how the protest movement evolved last year.
As the demonstrations grew, their anger turned to a new target. Iranian-backed Shia militia groups that were operating with increasing impunity throughout Iraq. Protesters set militia bases on fire, and the militias fought back. They were accused of unleashing a wave of assassinations against their critics.
That's the beginning of a new investigative documentary for PBS Frontline. It's called Iraq's Assassins. Filmmaker Ramita Navai joins us now from London. Ramita, your film gets into the political life of Iraqis and focuses on activists who may be on a kill list. They're being targeted, it's believed, by militias acting in Iraq on behalf of Iran. What drew you to the story?
Well, actually, I started out looking into the resurgence of ISIS in Iraq. And this was a story that I'd been following for years. So in 2016 for Frontline, I'd investigated how the Shia militias had been using the war against ISIS to settle old sectarian scores. So they were imprisoning, abusing and killing Sunnis. But since then, these militias have become even more powerful, even more entrenched in government. And what's extraordinary is that now they've turned against their own. So they've been killing anyone who criticizes them, who they deem a threat, including Shias. It's not just Sunnis. And I would say this is the important story in Iraq right now. It's not ISIS. It's the Shia militias.
So we meet several activists in the documentary. One of them is a charity worker, Lodia Ramon. She's been accused by Iran-backed media of being a foreign agent working for the U.S. She's frightened, and in this clip, we can hear why.
Lodia's friends started getting murdered. Sara Talib and her husband Hossein were shot dead in their home. Sara was several months pregnant. Journalist Ahmed Abdul Samad and Zafar Ali were gunned down in the street. Software engineer Tahsim Osama was shot in his office. Lodia worried she was next.
Yeah, understandably. Ramita, tell us about Lodia Ramon. What has she had to endure to stay even moderately safe?
Well, she's a remarkable woman because she's so brave, and I don't say that lightly. So she started getting death threats, as did all her friends, in 2019 when these mass protests erupted across Iraq. And they still continued to protest. They still believed that their protests could bring about change. And at the time, they were protesting a lack of basic services like electricity. But then their anger had turned against the militias. And young Iraqis like Lodia had dared to criticize the militias and had dared to criticize what they see as Iranian influence in Iraq. And that's when the death threats started. And when her friends started getting killed, Lodia absolutely continued until she was shot at. She now has fled and she still lives in fear, but she's living in an area outside militia control.
So the targeting of activists, we learn, is part of a bigger picture. In your film, you argue that the Iraqi city of Basra, kind of the gateway to Iran, it's controlled by Iran-backed militias. And you talk about one militia in particular, Kataib Hezbollah. How deep is that group's influence?
Kataib Hezbollah is one of the most powerful and secretive of all the militias in Iraq. It's Iranian-backed. So there have been a few investigations into Kataib, which have led to the belief that it is directly controlled by Iran. Now, Kataib Hezbollah have been attacking U.S. and coalition forces in Iraq. And these attacks surged after the US drone strike that killed one of its founders, the militia leader called Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, and an Iranian general called Qasem Soleimani. If you remember, that was last year.
Right.
And since then, these attacks against US and coalition forces have surged, and Kataib Hezbollah have been acting with impunity. And the Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi, has tried to take them on, but failed. And he's pretty impotent when it comes to taking this powerful militia on.
Near the end of your film, Ramita, the Iraqi charity worker and activist you spoke with, Lodia Ramon, she asks why Iran and the U.S. have chosen her country, Iraq, to be their battleground. What do you say to that?
Well, Lodja reflects what many Iraqis are thinking and feeling, and she reflects what was being chanted by thousands of Iraqis in the mass protests. Iran out, America out. They see these two countries as using Iraq as a battlefield, and this is their proxy war. And in a way, it suits Iran to have the US busy in Iraq with its militias because it's keeping America preoccupied. But of course, Iran's goal is to keep its Shia crescent going and free with Shia allies and influence, which stretches all the way from Tehran through Iraq, through Syria to Lebanon, which, of course, is a bulwark against the United States and, of course, Israel.
Journalist Ramita Navai speaking with me about her film Iraq's Assassins. You can watch it tomorrow night on PBS Frontline. Ramita, thank you very much for telling us about your reporting.
Thanks so much, Marco.
After more than a decade of legal battles, a group of Nigerian farmers beat one of the world's largest oil companies. The Court of Appeal in The Hague ruled that Shell is responsible for damage caused in the Niger Delta. Joining me now is Hanna Sankalden, the lead lawyer representing the farmers in court. This is a historic win, but what does it actually mean now for the farmers who are affected by Shell's pollution in Nigeria? Will they get compensation? Will Shell be ordered to clean up the disaster they created?
At this point, Shell's not been ordered to clean up the disaster they created, at least not in our specific cases. But the court did rule, indeed, that Shell is liable for the damages suffered. So the next step would be to determine the amount of damages they're entitled to see what should be part of the compensation. Hopefully, we will get to discussing that with Shell soon.
In terms of the wider impact of this case, we managed to speak with Chima Williams. He's an advocate for the farmers. This is what he said.
It has set a new legal order in terms of holding corporations accountable in their home states for their misdeeds in their host countries, irrespective of how weak or strong those victims are.
So, Hanna, what is the wider implication here from this case in the Netherlands about holding multinationals responsible for pollution in countries where they operate? Will the Netherlands keep the pressure on Shell, for example, to rectify the problems in Nigeria or anywhere any multinationals operate?
Well, of course, we'll have to see. But this case has been an important one because it's the first time the Dutch court has ruled that the parent company of Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, had a duty of care to make sure that leak detection systems were installed in the pipelines in the Niger Delta. In one of the cases where such system had not been installed, the court ordered them to make sure that this has been done within a year. It made it clear that the Dutch parent company has a role to play also in its activities in Nigeria. That ruling might have larger consequences for other multinationals, be it within the Netherlands or elsewhere.
So whether the Netherlands keeps the pressure on Shell or not, you say we'll have to see. So do you think we'll be seeing more cases like this in high courts or courts of appeals moving forward, environmental pollution cases across national borders?
Well, we see them happening all the time, actually, these days. And I'm quite certain that this judgment will be a motivation also for other victims and other NGOs, perhaps, to make sure that the pressure keeps on. I think both within the jurisdiction of the Netherlands, but also elsewhere. And of course, this Friday, we can expect a judgment of the Supreme Court in the United Kingdom when it's about parent company liability, also in a case against Shell. So I think it's definitely a development that is moving quite quickly. And when the legislators in different countries are just not moving quick enough, then the victims and other people with interest will address the courts to make sure that justice is being delivered.
So the oil that spilled into the Niger Delta did irreparable damage on ecosystems and on the people who live there. Our producer asked Chima Williams what the legacy of the pollution was for the Nigerian farmers, and this is how he responded.
Living on polluted land, drinking polluted water, dying on polluted land, and being buried in polluted land.
I mean, Chima's view is that pollution has become this dystopian constant that defines one's entire life in the Niger Delta. Where do you even begin to compensate for that? What do you think justice looks like for your plaintiffs in this case?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. And the problem is, of course, much more severe than just the problems we've been discussing in our specific case. And I think nothing that Shell can do in our case, you know, could possibly compensate for the entire spectrum of the problems that exist in the Niger Delta. This judgment just makes it very clear that Shell will need to do a total review of its policies in the Niger Delta, because everything they're doing is now within view of the world. We're all watching it.
I'm just wondering what you told your clients, the plaintiffs, Hanna. I mean, you won, even though it doesn't feel like it?
Well, I think it did feel like it for them. I mean, they realized quite a way that it was a spectacular judgment, and it felt like justice after so many years. What I told them is, be aware, you will have to be more patient because we're not there yet. And depending on the attitude that Shell will adopt in this coming period of time, we'll have to see how that goes and how quickly we can actually give my clients what they are entitled to and what they've been waiting for such a long time.
Hanna Somkalden is the lead lawyer representing Nigerian farmers in their lawsuit against Shell. She's been speaking with us from Leiden in the Netherlands. Hanna, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Environment stories can sometimes feel like a doom scroll. Here at the show, we're just as interested in solutions, reporting on the climate with an eye on the future. Find more of our solutions-based reporting on the climate in The Big Fix, our weekly look at ways of fixing the problem. The Big Fix is also online. Check it out at theworld.org/bigfix. South Africa's coronavirus vaccine rollout has taken a step back. They're hitting pause on distribution of the AstraZeneca vaccine after study results revealed disappointing efficacy against a new variant of COVID there. The study found that the vaccine offered minimal protection against mild and moderate cases of COVID-19. Experts remain hopeful, however, that the vaccine will prevent severe cases of the disease. To discuss all of this, we're joined by Dr. Barry Bloom, a professor of immunology and infectious diseases at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Dr. Bloom, first of all, what can you tell us about the study in South Africa and this AstraZeneca vaccine?
So in South Africa, which has a very good science infrastructure, they have done a small study of people who have had the rapidly progressing new variant, and it is very refractory to the immune responses generated by the AstraZeneca vaccine. So the virus is in the process of trying to elude the immune response. The good news is there is still significant protection from three of the existing vaccines. The bad news is the AstraZeneca vaccine seems to be doing no more than 10% protection against this variant, and hence they stopped the studies in South Africa, which seemed futile, expensive, taxing of people and money.
So it sounds like what you're saying is the coronavirus is essentially adapting to this particular vaccine in South Africa.
It's adapting to all the vaccines, and this one seems not to have the resilience to recognize parts of the new South African variant. Clearly, AstraZeneca's does not.
There does seem to be reason for concern, though. I mean, we're talking about the AstraZeneca vaccine in South Africa, but is there reason to believe other vaccines would also be less effective against this new strain or new strains? And just generally, how worried are you that the narrative of the pandemic could be mutation, vaccine redevelopment to deal with the mutations, and that goes on indefinitely?
So worrying is not a major tool in the field of public health. I try to think about what can we do once we're faced with a challenge or a problem, and problems represent opportunities for science to do better than, in this case, natural infection. So this is a global infection. A mutant or variant anywhere is a threat everywhere. And so we can't be complacent and say, because hopefully we start to do well by summertime in the US, we will not be invaded by a new variant. So we really have to continue public health measures, wearing masks, reducing opportunities for spread, and being very careful, because even with vaccines, they're not perfect. No vaccine has ever been perfect. And we're going to have to be in a world that is more thoughtful about protecting ourselves from respiratory infection than we have ever had to do before.
Even with those imperfections and with new mutations, Dr. Bloom, I suspect the importance of getting people vaccinated is even more crucial. Can you just give us the layperson's explanation of why when it comes to new mutations?
Sure. So what we know is that the best way to prevent the emergence of mutants is to reduce the amount of circulating viruses that hang around and can make mutants. So the lower the number of viruses in the community, the lower the number of viruses in any individual through face masks, through distancing, through avoiding crowding places, through washing of hands, the lower that number is, the lower the probability a mutant will emerge. That's the simplest of all facts. The ideal of a vaccine is simply to reduce the number of infectious viruses as a way of reducing the number also that can paint mutants.
Dr. Barry Bloom, a professor of immunology and infectious diseases at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Marco.
In the world of sports, life goes on, sort of, but with major changes. The NFL pulled off the Super Bowl last night, seemingly without a hitch. It even looked like the stadium was full. In reality, most of the fans were cardboard cutouts, you know, spectators in the era of COVID. Producing major sporting events has been no easy feat during the pandemic. Take the case of the Australian Open that kicked off today. The lead up to one of the Grand Slams of tennis has been fraught with tension and cabin fever. But as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, they made it work.
1,200 players and staff started arriving down under in mid-January. Everyone flew in on chartered flights before entering a mandatory 14-day quarantine. If everything went well, players were allowed to leave their hotel rooms for 5 hours a day during that time. But if just one traveler on a flight tested positive when they touched down, well, then the whole plane lost those privileges and had to stay in their room without training. This ended up affecting 72 players, including Yulia Putintseva of Kazakhstan. She wasn't happy and said players weren't told about these strict rules. Still, she abided and improvised. Lockdown players rearranged hotel furniture to make mini tennis courts in their rooms, hitting balls against walls, dressers, and windows. Just don't tell the front desk. Serbian star Novak Djokovic tried to skirt the rules by asking tournament organizers to reduce isolation periods and move players to private houses with tennis courts. That didn't work. Most players, though, understood the deal and isolated without complaints. Japanese player Taro Daniel documented his 14 days online and managed to rig a way to train for the heat by taking a stationary bike into the shower and steaming up the bathroom. That is dedication. Seven-time Australian Open champion Serena Williams is also in Australia. She praised the quarantine measures in an interview with Stephen Colbert.
It's super, super strict, but it's worth it because you want everyone to be safe at the end of the day.
Safe at the end of the day. Everyone was. Until late last week. Here's the Australian Premier, Daniel Andrews.
Late today, we were notified that a 26-year-old man from Noble Park has tested positive for coronavirus.
Even with these strict measures, an employee at one of the athlete hotels tested positive, sending more than 500 players back into quarantine just days before the tournament began. It's a reminder of how vulnerable big sporting events still are right now, and puts the logistical challenge of this summer's Olympics into perspective. More than 10 times the amount of Aussie Open athletes and staff will head to Tokyo, where they won't be subject to quarantine or isolation upon arrival. Officials at the International Olympic Committee say, after a year-long postponement, their emphasis will be on personal responsibility. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
That'll do it for us. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we will see you back here tomorrow.